right, so some of this, I guess, well, Glenn and Jean-Philippe, you guys will have a sense of this. Louis-Philippe, I know we spoke to you this week, so some of this might be old, but some of this is probably going to be new as well.
All right, I shall follow.
All right, so anyway, to give you a sense, we'll start with this economic situation that's developing right now. And we've got four major crises which are developing, or four major flashpoints for a potential blowout. Now, we have this situation with the yen carry trade, which has, it's been indicated by the Bank of Japan that this will be dried up. This is about $350 billion in cash, ready cash, that would be available for quick borrowing. And now this was at a basically a zero or negative interest rate charge to the borrower. And what would occur is that this money would be taken and would be invested in the so-called emerging economies, places like Iceland and places in Eastern Europe, Australia and New Zealand are several examples of this. Now, with this drying up, what is going to happen now is you have these overheated economies, which where certain bubbles have been built up either in real estate, on the stock markets, and so on. Now, when the money, the liquidity, which is driving these bubbles, dries up, this causes a collapse of these speculative bubbles. And we saw this with Iceland around the time of Lynn's last webcast. So there are several markets around the world where this is certainly a threat, where we could see more of these economies going down in the near future. Now, the yen carry trade is also tied in with the second flashpoint, which is the collapse of the U.S. housing bubble. Now, apparently, the value of the U.S. Mortgage and derivatives market that's tied in to the U.S. mortgages is approximately $15 trillion. And in this situation where the banks have lent out the majority of this money, there's no possible way that they can get this back. So you have massive overextension on the part of your major banks, like Citibank, JP Morgan, and so on. And with interest rates rising in the United States right now, you have a slowing down of this housing bubble which has been created. And as in our recent EIR, just to read several lines of an article relating to this, the writer says, at some point the growing inventory of expensive new homes will collide with the reality of an expanding inventory of older homes which haven't been able to find a buyer, producing a logjam and a blowout. However, such a blowout can occur even before that, if over-leveraged homeowners perceive a crash coming and seek the nearest exit from the market at any price. So what we're seeing here is an intersection of several different crises, any of which could trigger the blowout of the others. So this is something to keep in mind. And the fact that this system, this insane system created in 1971, is built upon creating instability. Because this is how the speculators make their money. I mean, if the market didn't move, if nothing happened, they wouldn't have anything to buy or sell. So they promote instability, which is rather suicidal. And now the other thing about this is clearly that it's based upon anticipating changes in the way that the market is going. Right, and back to the example of Iceland, that the blowout of the Iceland market was caused by, I think it was Fitch's rating agency, it was either Fitch's or Moody's, came out with a poor report or a forecast on the directionality of the Icelandic market. And this was enough to basically send these speculators scurrying for cover. So this is something to be taken into consideration as these various bubbles and various flashpoints develop. Now, this situation with the increase of interest rates is crucial. been going up over the last year or so in the United States. And it's important to also note that the U.S. is continuously having to borrow increasing amounts of funds, either from overseas, from its own people, from hedge funds, and so on, to keep its system functioning. Now, in order to increase the amount of money that they're able to borrow, they're almost forced to raise their interest rates, which is which is not a good method of maintaining a housing bubble, when apparently two-thirds of people who are now taking out mortgages are taking out interest-only loans, meaning that they can't even afford to make a down payment on the homes that they're purchasing. So a rise in interest rates at this point is like the proverbial straw that breaks the camel's back. So a 1 or 2% increase could also be enough to send this bubble tumbling. Now, the third major flashpoint is the situation with General Motors. And from what we've been told, the General Motors bonds and the derivatives associated with those bonds are the most traded pieces of paper on the bond market right now. And the way I kind of think of this is like a game of hot potato, where the music's playing and all these hedge funds and speculators are swapping these bonds and different contracts and obligations back and forth like crazy, making small, making profits off this and the profits off the daily changes in the value of these bonds. And they're just waiting for the music to end. And the question is, who will get caught with the with the bonds when the whole thing comes down? But in the meantime, this insane game is being played out. So this is the other thing that is occurring right now. Now, the fourth is something that's developed recently, or we've gotten reports recently of, which is the hyperinflation in commodity prices. Now, we've spoken about this, and we've gotten some reports over the last few months, but now we're seeing clearly that we've entered a new phase, and LaRouche, who in the fall, in September, made a forecast that with the Hurricane Katrina and the response with the oil prices, when this occurred, he forecast that we were now entering into a period similar to the hyperinflationary period of Weimar Germany in 1923. Now, since January, and I'll read a section from the briefing today which goes over, which is comparing the rise in prices of certain commodities over the last 4 years, or approximately the last two and a half to 3 years, and over the last 3 months, to give a sense of how this situation has changed extremely rapidly over the since the fall when LaRouche made this forecast. Now, it starts up. The commodities prices defining characteristic now is an increase in the rate of increase. For example, between March 31st, 2003 and December 30th, 2005, the price of palladium rose from $170 to $257 per ounce. For that whole 33-month period, its rate of increase, or its rate of price increase, was 51.1%. Its average rate of increase came out to a hefty 18.6% per year during that span. However, since the start of the year, palladium's price has subsequently jumped from 257 to 348 per ounce by April 12th, which, were it to continue, would come out to an increase of 132% for the year 2006. Between March 31st, 2003, and December 30th, 2005, a metric ton of aluminum increased in price at a rate of 13% per year. For 2006, its annual rate of increase is 72%. For a metric ton of zinc, between March 31st, 2005, and December 30th, 2005, its price increased at a considerable inflationary rate of 55% per year. For the year 2006, its annual rate of increase is 220%. Now, these examples are typical of what is occurring in the commodities market at this time. And we have been told by an analyst of these markets that approximately $100 billion was invested in the commodities markets at the end of 2005. And this is what is now driving the rapidly hyperinflationary prices that we just went over. And beyond that, we are talking about billions of other dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars more that are continuing to move into this sector. So we can imagine the effect upon the physical economy, where production is brought literally to a standstill on the one hand because they can't afford to buy the raw materials with which to produce their goods, or a refusal on the part of companies to pay these prices, understanding that it's no longer feasible to do so, will cause a rupture in this bubble when you have massive amounts of materials building up with no buyers. As we're seeing right now in copper, for example, which it's approximated this year will be in the range, there will be a surplus in the range of 200,000 to 300,000 tons. So now this is the situation on the economic front, where you have these four interrelated speculative-based bubbles, which are all coming to a head at this time, and could cause the blowout. Well, one could cause the blowout of all of them, or one of them, or any of them. So this is the situation here. Now, this situation is driving, of course, the situation with Cheney, right, and the drive for war with Iran. And we've been receiving increased chatter over the recent period, the last week and a half specifically, which tells us that there are moves being made right now within the institutions to put something in motion for some kind of probably a bombing attack or a limited strike against Iran to provoke some kind of crisis situation in the Middle East, which would allow Cheney to push through some kind of emergency dictatorial measures along the lines of what Hitler did after he became chancellor with the Reichstag fire. So, of course, as we've been saying for months now, this means Cheney has to go. And a good indicator of the state of mind of the people right now, and this may have come up in the briefing this evening again, was the response of the fans at a baseball game recently, where Cheney threw the opening pitch of the season, but he was literally booed out of the stadium. And an usher who had been working at the stadium for apparently about 50 years, he said he had never seen anybody booed like that in his life. So this is and I guess he threw a pretty bad pitch. So this is the situation. We know that the people in the United States are far ahead of the politicians around this issue of getting rid of Cheney. And it seems like they understand much better than the Democrats the real threat that this guy represents and the odious nature that he exudes. They don't like fascism. So now, of course, who is going to mobilize the Democrats, right? This is where we come in as the limb. And several things that have happened recently. We had Cody Jones out on the West Coast get the award for Democratic Man of the Year from, I guess, the 43rd Assembly District of the Democratic Party. So he's going to be receiving this award soon. We've also got Lakeisha Rogers campaigning for, I think, the chair of the Democratic Party in Texas. And she's getting a very good response from the Democrats in that area and from the population as she engages in this campaign. We have the Franklin Roosevelt Legacy Club, which has been opened up in the California Democratic Party. So we have these developments going on. We have, of course, developments in Washington and in Boston, which are telling us that the Dems are opening up more and more all the time. But there's one problem with these developments is you have Felix Roatan. And we're at a point now where we're in a fight for civilization. And there's two proposals on the table. There's Roatan and there's Lim. And nobody else has come forward with any other serious proposal on what to do about this crisis. Now, the collapse itself may not necessarily cause a dark age. Just like in 1929, the stock market collapsed. It's true. But the real collapse occurred afterwards, when the policies that Hoover had put in place and Andrew Mellon were maintained up through until the Roosevelt came into power. And so what we're looking at now is what kind of response will the people have? What will we do? And with these two proposals, we have a very clearly defined either a banker's dictatorship form of world government, where nation states are merely the appendages of financier power, or we have Lin's proposal of a community of nation states. And this is it. So we have to understand that we're at a point now where we can no longer be Hamlet, and we have to make a choice. So we have to ask ourselves, what are we willing to do at this point? And this is what we have to take to the people. And in Canada, now, obviously, the limb in the United States is mobilizing around getting rid of Cheney, right, and making sure the Roatan becomes, an also-ran, as they say in English, right, a nobody. We're gonna destroy this guy. But what about Canada? What is our role going to be up here? Now, what we have to be thinking about is creating the kind of environment in Canada that will allow our country to survive. Because it's not clear to me right now, and it's not assured that Canada could survive the kind of economic catastrophe that is looming before us right now. So we have to think about mobilizing the institutions, like Glenn, JP, and I began to do last week, and as we began really in December with the CAW intervention in Toronto, right, is to get these people acting and to get them thinking and reading Lin's stuff and building these networks up, getting the government to move and getting them to think about the potential, the possibilities for action out there. They may not move now. They may not move before the crisis hits, but the important thing is that these people have a sense of what needs to be done when they realize that they can't hesitate any longer, right? And if we allow the only proposals on the table to be those typical or typified by Roatan, well, that becomes a problem for Canada's future, and that becomes a problem for humanity as a whole. Now, we also have to create the kind of collaborative forces within Canada who are going to be working in the sense of a hemisphere-wide movement of people who are going to be working together to build the kind of republic that will be necessary to ensure that we have functioning and healthy and growing societies in the future. So this is where we stand in Canada. And this is where we stand with the financial situation and the fight that we're in. So I guess with that, I don't know if you have any questions related to this, I can answer that, or you guys can probably talk further after you get done with the economics.
Yeah, what do you think, our role has changed since Stephen Harper has arrived as Prime Minister? Do you think our role as Canadian with Americans has changed, not only our relation, but what we have to do facing the American government?
Well, I don't think it's changed fundamentally. I think, in a sense, it makes more clear that we have forces within Canada that are moving to put the kind of people in place which will not go with a kind of a Roosevelt model. And it seems also that, well, you have this thing in Canada, I mean, whether it was really the Liberals or the Conservatives or even the NDP, that all of these parties are controlled by the same people. So a change in government is not necessarily indicative of any change in the potential for action that these guys represent. I would say that maybe the biggest threat is that we have these weak minority governments right now in a time where you need a leader who has the capacity for decisive and quick action, as Roosevelt was able to take as soon as he came into office. Right, and now I think also this, we have to take into consideration the kind of divisions that exist within Canadian society right now, and look at these as weaknesses or structural weaknesses, which the oligarchy could very easily exploit. Right, when the people are confronted with this kind of the nature of the crisis that is that we're faced with right now, but in terms of who Harper represents as compared to Martin or so on, I mean, Harper probably represents more of the fundamentalist aspect, and you know, there's this question of the Chicago, or not the Chicago School, the University of Calgary, and many of the people around Harper, and Harper himself come out of the University of Calgary. And from what little we know of this, we're looking at the neocon center in Canada, or one of the centers of neoconservatism, and I think this is tied in with the University of Chicago. So yeah, we have this element that needs to be dealt with, but fundamentally it's the same fight. And I think it just makes a bit more clear that the powers that be are moving. You know, with the understanding that this crisis is here, and they need to want to get their man in position, right, for when this whole thing goes down. But it just emphasizes what we need to do in terms of our organizing, right, to mobilize the people and really bring them to the reality of this situation, right, that we can't, that there's not really time to hesitate anymore.
All right.
Does that kind of...
Yeah, that answered my question.
All right, cool.
Yeah, Rob.
Yeah?
Because I'm not Canadian. I want to know, you know much of the details of these institutions, which are pretty much behind, you said all three of the major parties, is there some sort of policy shaping institutions which have their hands dipped in all three? What's the story there?
Well, I think I've read a little bit on this one. You've got this one power, it's called Power Corp, and you've got a family in Quebec, they said of Quebec, called the Desmarais family. Like, I think Paul Desmarais is right now kind of the head of this dynasty. Mm. And apparently, you've got four of our most recent, or I guess all four of the last prime ministers, except Kim Campbell, worked for this guy. Except Turner too, but you had Trudeau, you had Mulroney, Chrétien, and Martin, all worked for this family, right? So you have also this guy Maurice Strong, who is he's working with the Oil for Food program. He was involved with that. He's one of the major zero growth freaks, negative population growth freaks. And this guy is like the controller of Suzuki. So yeah, this is one particular family. Then you've got I think the elements behind the Bank of Montreal. That's really key, and certain other corporations that are tied in with the bank, with the Club of the Isles. You know, you've got like Toronto Dominion Bank, Bank of Montreal. You've got companies like Inco, which is a big nickel producer. You know, companies like this. I think the Desmarais family is probably one of the top groups. I mean, these guys are tied in, I think, with a lot of European banking circles. But Power Corp is huge. I think they're just a massively influential corporation in Canada. I mean, see, this is one of the things we need to do more. This is one of the areas we need to do some more research into. I think Jean-Francois has done some work into Power Corp. We could ask him to get us some more documentation on this.
Yeah, we have some documents from him here.
Yeah, I think that would be something very useful to look at, because it might be good, a very effective leaflet even, because we hit up Demarais before last winter with a leaflet attacking their economic policies that are being pushed by these kinds of people. There are different institutions that are shaping policy in Canada. You have the Fraser Institute, which is based out west. These guys are saying we should privatize everything, like even the streams and the creeks, basically. You know, because if everything is privatized and everybody owns everything, then everything has somebody to protect it. You know, then the streams and the water will be, you know, we'll be able to keep it clean because there will be some kind of vested interest there to defend it, or some insane stuff like that. There's also, I don't know, JP, do you remember what the name of the, there's an institute in Quebec, a really right-wing institute as well. I think it's Helen Demarais.
It's Institut Économique de Montréal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and these guys are, I think, the Quebecois version of the Fraser Institute.
Yeah, it's more Pelerinite stuff.
Yeah.
But one thing that was said in the briefing today, mm-hmm. at the end during the Q&A, I asked a question about the support that Lelouch had for his proposal and not just his support for his forecast.
Mm-hmm.
And Harley said that that people should smoke out economic teachers,
mm-hmm.
to figure out, you know, well, for example, economic teachers, but people in economics,
yeah.
figure out where they belong, because of course, if Power Corp financed such think tank like Institut Économique, for mm-hmm. example, these guys are definitely involved up to a certain, very deeply.
Yeah.
So they can smoke out some teachers and create some ruckus in universities and other mm-hmm. places.
Yeah, I think we should definitely be targeting these people.
We probably found some of them the other day.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, Toronto.
I would say so.